All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I am totally energized. It's like I stuck my finger in a light socket. And that's what that song does to me, all right? So I'm just sitting here abuzz, okay? So it's going to be a great show today. At the back end of the show, a very special segment of the show. It's an interview I did with the director, one of the key characters in a new film that's debuting. It's actually opening up nationwide as we speak, and it's called Fire in the Blood. And we'll be talking with director Dylan Mohan Gray and Dr. Jamie Love, one of the main characters in the film. And it's about how this system has systematically denied anti-AIDS drugs to millions of people, thereby systematically causing the unnecessary death of many millions, at least 10 million people around the world who couldn't afford to get AIDS treatment. And why were they blocked? Because of patents, intellectual property rights, and profits. Opening this show up, though, we're still right in the middle of one of the most intense times we've had in a very long time. It's the U.S. threats against Syria, what's going on in the Middle East, all the stuff that's just ratcheting up continuously. It seems every day you get something new in there. In the wake of Obama's speech, U.S. planes and cruise missiles are still poised to inflict more suffering and death on the people in Syria. There's all this talk about the possibility of negotiating a settlement. It's all part of meeting the needs of U.S. empire, nothing less. And here to talk with us about that, to update us and dig into some of the other questions in here, is Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And he's a regular guest on our show. Larry, welcome.
Hey, Michael.
Let's jump into this. In the wake of Obama's speech, suddenly the possibility of a peaceful resolution to the crisis in Syria started to emerge. He sort of called off the debate in Congress. He then turned around and gave the speech that was supposed to be explaining things, but was actually, really, in a lot of ways, it seemed to me, was actually still asserting that, look, you know what? This military option is still very much alive, and we'll see what's going to happen, blah, 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 all this other stuff. Meanwhile, the Syrian people are still sitting under the gun. What do you think's going on there?
Well, first, I think the framework is important. This is a new twist in U.S. imperialism's effort to threaten Syria and maintain its dominance in the region. That's what's going on here with, as you said, Obama's speech, taking the threat of an immediate attack off the table for the moment. This wasn't motivated by the fact that he, quote-unquote, really doesn't want to go to war, or the fact that the people have spoken up, although broad opposition figured into this whole equation, or that the U.S. rulers came to their senses and actually want to give peace a try. This latest twist really came about as part of this inter-imperialist contention between the United States and Russia, and then on Monday, Russia, in connection with Syria, put forward that, well, Syria is willing to give up its chemical weapons, so you don't need to attack. And Assad has agreed to this. So this was an effort by the Russians to head off what they see as a very strategically bad thing that would affect their interests, in other words, an attack on Syria. And I think the U.S. ruling class, at least for the moment, took this up because they are up against a lot of very complex contradictions. They don't have any good options in Syria. The internationally, the various global powers are not lining up behind what they wanted to do. They have their contention with Russia. There's deep discontent in this country, and there are very sharp differences within the ruling class in this country over what to do. Hence, Obama hits the pause button for now. But as you mentioned quite correctly, this is not a moment to breathe a sigh of relief. We just read they're escalating their arming of the Syrian rebels, so-called. Both Kerry and Obama have repeated, no, listen, we need a resolution quickly or there will be an attack. So people need very much to be on the alert and very much be speaking out against any U.S. attack.
Let me ask you this, Larry. Let me ask you this, because you just brought this in. I think it's indicative of sort of how intense the contradictions are. You know, there's this thing that's going on now with the Russians and Syria. And at the same time, Assad seems to be asserting some of his own sort of, all right, I'm gonna make my play now because I got to get out there and do this. You know, it's my survival is at stake. My regime is at stake. He's actually talked about how that, okay, he's got two things he's dangling out there. One is he's talking about joining the treaty against chemical weapons, but he's demanding that others do so as well, including Israel gets into its nuclear weapons and signs off on what they have and promises not to use them and get rid of them and whatnot. He also said that maybe this Russian agreement is dependent upon the U.S. stops arming the rebels.
I think what you're pointing to is the fact that a lot of, you know, I've read articles saying, oh, war's off the table, now's the time for disarmament. No, imperialism's still on the table, and there's imperialist diplomacy, there's imperialist war, there's imperialist arms inspections, there's imperialist economics. All of these different tools by the U.S. uses together to advance its interests. So the diplomatic talks that are going on now, the talk about arms agreements and inspections, all of that is part of the toolkit the U.S. rulers will use and have used in the past for their interests. If you look at the attacks on Iraq in both 1991 and 2003, there were diplomatic efforts that preceded those in which they were complicated back and forth, and basically in which the target of the U.S. attack would put forward, and as what you're saying, different proposals, in this case by Assad, that seemed totally reasonable in a certain sense, and the U.S. would find ways to say, no, 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 those are unreasonable, and we've still walked the last mile for peace. Now we're justified in attacking, and they've done this not to, quote unquote, give peace a chance. They've done it to enlist the population and other powers in the case of Iraq in war. I'm not saying it's inevitable that they're going to attack Syria, although that seems still quite likely. Or you look at the case of Iraq in the 1990s with the weapons inspections. Those weapons inspections were used to spy on Saddam Hussein, to vilify Saddam Hussein, to prepare really a case for war against Saddam Hussein, even to use coup attempts. So all these are part of imperialist efforts, in this case, to gravely weaken or ultimately take down the Assad regime in order to more firmly assert their control, principally by weakening Iran. And I just have to say this, Michael, in terms of the news coverage that is being spewed out, all of it is from the viewpoint of the empire, and they're trying to train people in viewing it. Just this morning in the New York Times, there was a report on the point you just made that Assad had proposed that Israel, which has chemical weapons and hasn't signed the convention against them. This is the New York Times coverage of Assad's proposal. They say Israel has signed the accord but not ratified it. It is extremely unlikely to do so in light of the difficulty of verifying Syrian compliance. Oh, so it's not Israel's fault that they're not going to sign it. It's Assad's, because it's hard to verify whether he's complied or not. So snuck into this editorial, or this so-called news report, you have a whole imperialist argument about how Israel is legitimate in what it's doing, but it's Assad that's the problem.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. Larry is a journalist with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about the current crisis in Syria. You know, Larry, we have about maybe 6 minutes left, and I want to dig into two things. And I think they're both around the question of the possibility of an encroaching war. What can be done to stop that? And I think that's a critical question, including I'd like to talk a little bit about one of the things about Obama's speech, as you mentioned, was training people to view the world in a certain framework, training people how to think. And there has to be, in order to stop this, it seems there has to be a whole other framework established. Can you talk about what has to be done?
Well, I think that is a key thing, because Obama, and there's an excellent article at revcom.us where I've been writing, and there's a lot of tremendous coverage of this, which I would encourage people to go to. It's called Obama's September Speech on Syria, More Lies for War from the Liar-in-Chief. And it just does a devastating refutation of Obama's claim that the world is a better place because for nearly seven decades, the U.S. has been the anchor of global security. What, global security for the people of Hiroshima? Wait, no, I'm sorry, they got destroyed. How about Vietnam? 2 to 3 million people killed. We can talk about Iraq in the 1990s with 500,000 children. We can talk about Iraq today, which is still suffering the result of U.S. aggression. In other words, the point is the U.S., nothing the U.S. imperialists do is about human rights, except to the degree sometimes that issue can be mustered in support of their imperialist interests. They are proceeding from dominating the world and protecting this entire system of global exploitation, which demands control of markets, labor, resources all over the world, and the prevention of others from doing so. And it's just led to enormous suffering. So rather than being the principal protector of humanity, the U.S. imperialism is a principal tormentor of humanity and impediment to anything positive coming for the whole planet. And this article just dissects this. And I think it's really important to understand this is in operation now. You know, I've read emails, people say, oh, I know all about U.S. imperialism. It's done bad things in the past. But darn it, right now we have to act to stop this genocide and the use of chemical weapons. Well, look, that isn't what the U.S. is going there to do. It's going there to assert its power, and so far it's been working to do that by dragging out the Syrian civil war and contributing to the 100,000 deaths and 2 million refugees. That's what it has done. Look at the excuses that it used to invade Iraq in 2003. One of them was Saddam Hussein has used chemical weapons on his own people. Well, that's a true point that, A, the U.S. helped him do that against the Kurds in 1988, which I document in my book, and, B, the U.S. was not concerned about protecting Iraqi lives. 4 million people in Iraq were driven from their homes by this war. 4 million injured, perhaps a 500,000 to 1 million killed. There are 1,000 people being killed a month in a civil war now. Where's the media spotlight on that? Where's the outrage about let's go find who created this horror and let's bring them to justice? No, you don't. That's just forget about it. It's only let's focus on the crime du jour that serves U.S. imperialist interests and getting people whipped up behind it. So I think that the key thing is I heard a couple talking about this in San Francisco, and this woman said to her husband, listen, why do we always have to take care of all the problems? And then her husband saying, well, this is a terrible thing. These are part of our principles to do this. And you wanted to tell her, look, first, there is no we. What the imperialists do is not in the interests of humanity. It's in their interests. It's antagonistic to the interests of humanity. And it's not doing anything good in the world. And no, to the husband, this isn't the principle on which the United States has been built and operates in this world. So we have to break people out of this whole framework of thinking that the U.S. is the good guys in the world, or at least this time it's trying to do something good. I mean, the whole debate that's going on right now, as this article really and other articles at RevCom point out, one is called No War for Imperialist Interests, and it points out how the whole debate gets framed in terms of what's good. You know, will we get stuck in a quagmire? In other words, imperialism. Is this going to give Russia too much power? Well, whose viewpoint is that? That's from the viewpoint of the U.S. rulers and so on. So this basically, it boils down to stop thinking like Americans. Let's start thinking about humanity.
All right, Larry, and that brings us right up to the edge. And I want to say, actually, as part of it, as closing out this segment, I want to thank you a lot for joining us. But I also want to say that this is certainly no time for people to actually relax in the wake of the speech or anything else, but it's a time for people to really step up their efforts to get out
and
play around.
I have a talk of mine that's also on RevCom. I gave a talk at Revolution Books in Berkeley, and you can watch it at revcom.us, and I'd really encourage people to do it as it also gets into, in more depth, the things we're talking about today. But there's a link at revcom.us to the talk, and people can watch it.
All right, great. That's exactly what I wanted to say. So thanks a lot, Larry, for joining us today.
Okay, Michael.
All right.
Take care.
All right. Talk to you again soon, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Larry Everest, reporter for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, with our update on what the hell is going on in relation to the U.S. and its assault against Syria and all the various contradictions that are popping up there. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Van Morrison. How can you stand it? It's Van Morrison with Educating Archie from his album Born to Sing, No Plan B. All right, that's it. All right, I'm going to be real quick introducing this segment. It's about a new film, Fire in the Blood, and it's opening nationwide right now, actually. And it's the story of one of the major crimes against humanity, one of the biggest crimes in human history, when Western imperialist, capitalist imperialist governments and pharmaceutical companies fought to deny low-cost AIDS drugs to people in poor countries using intellectual property rights, patents, and profits as the weapon to kill 10 million or more people. The movie is also about a diverse collection of people who fought back against this kind of chemical warfare. As a result of the struggle depicted in this film, millions of lives have been saved in the countries hardest hit by AIDS, especially in Africa. But the fight is far from over, as this system has immediately hit back and tightened up their laws and regulations to deny new generations of the generic antiretroviral drugs necessary to continue fighting AIDS in infected peoples. And this is a film that I saw at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And we're going to be talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, one of the key participants in the film, as well as in the struggle to get affordable AIDS medication to the people in Africa and other parts of the world that really need them for their survival. So without any further ado, let's listen to the interview.
Over 2 million people were reported to have died in that year alone.
The whole of Africa was being taken for a ride.
It's fine for people in rich countries to say this is what it ought to be. They don't have to live in these little villages and watch people die like flies.
Where are the drugs? The drugs are where the disease is not.
You fight our patent monopolies, we will make sure you die.
As long as drugs are not available to everybody, he will not take them.
It was just kind of a crisis of humanity. People just weren't really human for a moment.
They wanted to know where you could get the raw materials to make the AIDS medicine.
There was 30, 40 million white people that didn't have access to treatment. It would be the most important question you could possibly imagine.
The raw materials are all controlled by the multinationals.
People are dying and the medicines are in my briefcase.
South Africa goes, India goes, Brazil goes, Thailand goes, Argentina goes.
We are never going to stop until everyone in Africa, everyone in Asia, everyone in Latin America has access to drugs.
These are pirates on the high seas.
When I saw this film, which is called Fire in the Blood, and someone told me that, in fact, after you see it, you will have fire in the blood, and it may have been the man that I'm going to be talking with now, Dylan Mohan Gray, and he's the director of the film, and he warned me before I saw it that it was going to be, I was going to get angry about it, and I definitely did get angry. Dylan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you tell people what the film is about?
Well, this film is about three things, I would say. First of all, it's about something that I consider to be one of the great crimes in human history, which is how low-cost antiretroviral medicine was withheld from people in Africa and other parts of the developing world during the height of the AIDS pandemic. And a bare minimum of 10 million people died as a result of this. Furthermore, it's about a very interesting group of people from different parts of the world which came together to break this blockade and really did so in the face of very little interest and support from either civil society or the political community or the public health community. So people who were constantly being told, this is impossible, this can't be done, it'll never work, and yet doggedly persevered and powered through and actually changed the world. For me, this group of people is incredibly inspirational, and their applications to all kinds of other things beyond the topic of this film. I think anybody that sees this film has no excuse to sort of wring their hands and lament about the state of the world, because we have a group of incredibly powerful contributors and characters in the film who really showed that you can make a difference. And the third thing is the film is a warning call about conditions that are now sort of being set into place, where this a cataclysm of this magnitude could very easily be repeated in the next couple of years, as well as a deconstruction. It's an expose of the whole system of how drugs are developed and commercialized, which I think I can safely say is a deeply flawed and corrupt system.
When I first started following what was going on with AIDS in Africa, I had been in Africa for a while. I had spent some time in South Africa and in Southern Africa. Give people a sense of what it was like in that period of time, in the mid-80s to the 90s, what was it like there then?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is the hopelessness and the lack of ability to do something. Those were experiences shared by doctors in this country for a very long time prior to the breakthrough of triple therapy in 1996. It was a sort of a universal experience up to that point. And I think once the triple therapy came through in 96, you know, it was a sort of a miracle which took place. Unfortunately, the miracle was only extended to those either who had personal wealth or who happened to be lucky enough to live in countries where there were health systems that could provide funds to pay for their care. Our film very much focuses on the intervening period once the treatment had come in almost universally in Western countries, but was almost completely absent in developing countries, especially in those parts of the developing world which were most affected, meaning Central and Southern Africa and the Caribbean.
I used to watch the New York Times every year. They'd put out a map of AIDS in the world. And you would see the cases in the U.S., and there would be stick figures. And, you know, okay, it was sizable. As you went into other parts of the world, it would be huge. But then every time you would see Africa, Africa was the one place where the entire continent disappeared, covered with stick figures, beyond the borders of the continent. And I kept thinking about that as I was watching your film the other night. And when you talked about AZT, in fact, there's a point where really I remember AZT being a turning point in the treatment of AIDS. And there's a point in your film where someone says, it was a turning point, but exactly what you're saying, it was a turning point only if you were privileged enough to live in a privileged country. Can you talk about that a little more?
Well, you know, I think none of us are naive, and we know that, you know, those of us who have been lucky enough to have been born into families with certain material conditions that are in countries where, you know, people are generally taken care of, we have more access to things in general than people in poorer countries do. However, I think the special situation that exists in this particular case is it was a real global emergency. The loss of life was massive. The tools were completely present to deal with this, and it took quite a while for the people who had the ability to do something about it to step up. It's a huge waste, actually. I think that when we talk about intellectual property and commerce and trade, it is very important to differentiate between life-saving medicine and, say, iPads and Barbie dolls and toasters. So, I mean, these are things that, first of all, have largely been developed by taxpayer money. Secondly, they are different. Nobody's going to die if they don't get that iPad. So the attitude has to be different, and the system of commercialization, the system of distribution has to be different. And, you know, so often it's not the case, and people aren't, in many cases, even willing to discuss it as if it is different than all these other products. So when we showed the film in South Africa, there was a profound sense of mourning, which was a different response than we've had elsewhere. And I think it's just an incredible feeling of just what an immense waste this was, an immense waste of human life and vitality, families destroyed, children orphaned, completely needlessly. There was not even, as Jamie Love says in the film, there wasn't even a commercial impetus behind it. It was just a complete lack of empathy in a way, you know, on the part of those who could do something about it. And I think that sense of waste is very, very strong.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the film Fire in the Blood. And we're talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, who is one of the participants in the film and who has been fighting patents, profits, and intellectual property rights to get affordable AIDS medication for people all over Africa. Let me introduce Jamie Love. Jamie, you were in the film. What was your role?
I was involved in this very early stage. I think one of the reasons why I was profiled in the film is that just in terms of activists and people who are working on this, I started working on this issue about patent issue in Africa fairly early in the 90s. And well, among other things, I negotiated this dollar a day AIDS cocktail with Cipla, this Indian drug manufacturer, back in 2001. But before that, it had been the main person that was pushing to have a campaign against the exclusive rights of the patents, particularly on AIDS, but also for other diseases, focusing on a mechanism that's available to people legally to have the government override the exclusive right and grant compulsory licenses on the patents. And we pushed for a campaign, started around 1999. It was really a bigger campaign, 1998, 1999, on how you might begin to systematically go after the exclusive rights of the patent so you could get generic drugs. But at one point in this conversation, I mean, people weren't quite sure what it would actually cost to make generic drugs. I remember I talked to people at the White House at the time. This was on the Clinton administration. The White House started to get involved in AIDS and began to identify it as a national security problem. And I said to them, do you know what it would cost to manufacture the cheapest AIDS cocktail you could make? At that point, I think $10,000 a year was about the price in South Africa for the cheapest cocktail. I said, do you know what, if you got rid of all the patents altogether, what would it cost? And guy I talked to on the National Security Council said, well, I don't know. And I said, how could you not know the answer to that question? I mean, there's tens of millions of people whose lives at stake. Now, I asked people that the World Health Organization had assigned someone from Germany who'd worked in the pharmaceutical sector to work in this, and he sort of had the same idea. He didn't know, and it was sort of a lot of people were suggesting that it was sort of an unknowable thing, and I just thought that was ridiculous. I think in the film I was quoted as saying if it was 30 or 40 million white people that were going to die of a disease, somebody would know what the hell it cost to make the drug that would treat them. So I went to Thailand and talked to a government agency that actually made drugs. But I eventually tracked down Dr. Hamid, who was the CEO of Cipla, through a fellow named Bill Haddad, who's also in the film, who worked in the generic drug industry, and met with him in London. And we sat down and walked through what the cheapest aid cocktail you could make and how it would be done. And when that price was finally announced in February or January of 2001, that was a lot of things flew from that, because then it was crystal clear in a very concrete way that it was an artificial scarcity, that once you got the price down to a dollar a day, all this idea that it wasn't cost effective to treat people in Africa became much harder for people to make that argument. So things went fairly fast after that.
It's really repugnant, though, to think about this when people are even looking at cost effectiveness of treating human beings when you have the ability to treat them and keep them alive. I mean, we go through this all the time, the cost effectiveness of ending hunger in the world, you know, all these other things. One of the things I'd ask you, though, real quick, and then we'll go back to Dylan, but was the main block to people being able to get treated in Africa, to having access to these drugs, was it patents?
Well, if you go back to 1999, 2000, it was definitely, particularly in South Africa, it was definitely the patent situation, because, you know, if you thought you were facing a price of $10,000, and that's what the prices were at back then. Bristol-Myers Squibb, for example, had one drug they charged $14 a day for. It was a government-invented drug. It was just one of three you needed in a cocktail. I mean, it was really expensive to do things back then. So people were saying that it just didn't make any sense to train people, to set up the infrastructure, to test people, to do anything, because they couldn't afford the drugs anyhow. So then you had a lot of stories of people kind of justifying the lack of access. They'd say, oh, well, people in Africa don't know how to take the drugs, or they don't know how to tell time. Peter Jennings had a show on television back then where he said that if people in Africa got access to drugs, they wouldn't take them correctly and they developed resistance and would come back and harm Americans and Europeans. And so it was actually the right thing to do from a public health point of view, just to let them die so they wouldn't lead to this drug-resistant strain of AIDS and things. And that was kind of what you saw going on. In fact, the person that's the head of the Global Fund right now, he's a former official from the Bush administration. He was saying things that were ridiculous about the ability to run treatment program. But once the price point was actually changed, when you knew you could actually get drugs, and what was a dollar a day was 75 cents a day, and today was less than $100 a year. So the prices really fell after that. But once you sort of broke the patent issue, then I talked to Mitch Daniels, was George Bush, was the head of OMB. And Ralph, I used to work for Ralph Nader, and Ralph and I used to go see him. And at one point we were talking about this, and Mitch said when the price was couple thousand dollars a year, he thought that it just wasn't cost effective to do things in Africa for AIDS. He thought, well, if you're going to do AIDS, you should spend it on something else, like clean water or dealing with pneumonia or some other problem. But he said when it was a dollar a day, he felt that they were compelled to do it morally. But the moral thing didn't really kick in for him until he hit a dollar a day. And I think that's the way a lot of people really thought about that. But to their credit, once that price point hit, they really kicked it in. And then, you know, all this talk that you couldn't treat people began to change. And then, as you know, Kofi Annan and then later George W. Bush, they really supported the idea of these big multilateral funding. The French stepped up a bit. And now you have millions of people in treatment in Africa and throughout the developing world. So it's been a big change. Now, I think if you ask me what's going on right now, I think it would be right now a growing fight over access to cancer drugs, where there is no tradition of low prices in developing countries, and where the patent issue is a huge problem right now.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today about the film Fire in the Blood, and we're talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, who is one of the participants in the film and who has been fighting patents, profits, and intellectual property rights to get affordable AIDS medication for people all over Africa. Dylan, when we first started this interview, you talked about people who really made a difference, who stood up and said, I'm not going to stand by and let this go on. People for whom the morality issue kicked in a long time ago and had nothing to do with profit or protecting access to this medicine so that you could actually then profit greatly off of it. Who were these people?
Well, one of them is sitting right here with us, is Jamie Love. I often say to people when we watch the film, Jamie's role in this whole story and in the film, to me, embodies something that's very, very powerful and good. Because fundamentally, even though Jamie is dealing with issues of access to knowledge and intellectual property, fundamentally, he wasn't a person from the global public health community. He wasn't an AIDS person. All these people who were entrusted with dealing with global public health, we would portray just some of the institutions in the film, and you see these lavish halls and people, you know, in beautiful saris and suits and the string quartet that they listened to at the beginning of their meeting and all this. What were they doing? I mean, how many billions of dollars go to just supporting that superstructure? And a very simple question could not be answered. And Jamie went to many, many people. In fact, when I was editing the film, I think we left about 10 in there of the different institutions he mentioned, but I think he actually said about 20. So just didn't have the time to list them all. I mean, it was quite incredible. A complete lack of accountability, a complete lack of somebody stepping up to take responsibility. These are people who should have done it. Luckily, there was somebody like Jamie who did step up and who felt that this is a question there's no reason should not be answered. So, you know, Jamie was one. We had Dr. Mungeni from Kampala here. Again, somebody for me who played a huge role in this. We had, obviously, Zaki Ahmad in South Africa. Risked his life. Came very close to death. And it was a very, very important thing that he did. Dr. Hamid, obviously, in India. It was one of the few people that could have actually made this medicine. It almost certainly had to be an Indian because of the way the patent system worked.
Before we get into that, and I know you're going to have to run, but I can continue with Jamie. One of the things I wanted to ask you before you go is, is it Dr. Mungeni, you said? Let's talk about him, because he was a character. I mean, I was really impressed. Here was somebody who was hit in the head so many times, and this point about refusing to give up, refusing to bow down before all this, and saying, look, these are human beings, and I'm not going to turn my back on them, and fighting. And I want people to learn a little bit more about him, because he was a remarkable character in the film, and he certainly appears to be one of these remarkable people on the planet.
Yeah, I think he's a person of great moral stature, and he's a very, very committed medical doctor. He was exiled from Uganda during the regime of Idi Amin. He went to live in the UK, had a very prominent practice there. But when AIDS started to devastate his country, he gave that all up, came back to work for a very meager government salary, retrained himself in AIDS medicine, essentially to help his countrymen. And he's sort of a legend in Uganda. The story we show in the film, I don't think he ever wanted to be an activist, but he realized that the situation had made him a leader, not just a doctor. And he founded the largest AIDS treatment research center on the African continent, which is the Joint Clinical Research Center in Kampala. And he will tell you, he's personally watched many, many thousands of people die agonizing deaths because of lack of access to medicine. And at some point, he just had to take steps to intervene in that. And for a long time, he tried to work with the drug companies. He tried to work with the international organizations. He gave speeches. He traveled the world. The results didn't come. Finally, he literally just got on the phone and ordered the drugs from India. And whoever was on the other end of the line at Cipla was saying, well, you know, actually we're not allowed to import drugs to Uganda. The patents in place don't allow us to do that. He said, I'll take responsibility. He got the shipment of the drugs, knowing he would be facing arrest, and refused to leave the airport. and spent quite a significant amount of time in the airport. People around the country started to find out about this and started to gather at the airport. And it just so happened that Dr. Murjani has a lot more legitimacy in Uganda than the government. And I think the government was quite well aware of that. So unlike somebody like Zaki Ahmed, when he was smuggling drugs, knowing that he would get arrested and knowing that probably wouldn't succeed, but it would raise awareness, I think Dr. Murjani actually had somewhere deep down within a sense of confidence that they wouldn't actually throw him in the slammer. He refused to leave. And he said, you know, not only, first thing they said finally, oh, well, okay, you know, as an humanitarian gesture, we'll let this shipment of drugs in. And he said, that's not good enough, you know. These drugs have to be taken for life. So unless I get a guarantee that every future shipment will be allowed, you're going to have to put me in jail. Meanwhile, the crowds are gathering outside. It's a pretty remarkable story. And I mean, I was for a long time a student of history. And if you look back on events in history, it often is just really one person or two people just doing something they can do. But it just takes a moment for them to realize they can do it, you know. And I think that that was one of those moments that had a huge impact. And I have immense admiration for that man. And he's, like Jamie, a very humble person. But, you know, these are people that have had incredible positive impact on the planet.
All right, Dylan, I know you have. Do you have to leave now or do you? Yeah, okay. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today about the film Fire in the Blood, and we're talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, who is one of the participants in the film and who has been fighting patents, profits, and intellectual property rights to get affordable AIDS medication for people all over Africa. All right, Jamie, something that Dylan was just saying, where he was talking about Dr. Murjani and the fact that he stood up and demanded this in Uganda. At the same time, all of the rest of Southern and Eastern Africa was just, as you were saying earlier, was just swamped. So many things were lined up against even attempting, you know, there was no hope.
For many areas, there wasn't much of an infrastructure.
Right.
And the drug companies were trying to minimize the importance of access at that time. So they got this fella, Amir Otteron, who actually used to work for Ralph Nader. He used to work in the same office I worked in. And he was, I don't know whether he was like a rogue agent or what, but he started taking money from the drug companies and he started working against what was happening on the effort to knock down the patent barriers. And he wrote a paper where he showed that within Africa, in some countries you had patents, in some countries you didn't have patents, and you really had no treatment anywhere. I guess the point of his paper was, or what was pushed by pharma and by him, was to try and claim that patents weren't important because nobody was getting treatment regardless of whether there was patents in your country or not. It was really a misleading thing at the time because the one country that had the resources to provide treatment was South Africa, and they had about 40% of the GDP of the whole sub-Saharan Africa at the time, and they had patents like crazy. I mean, I think they had like 15 out of 17 AIDS drugs were patented in South Africa at the time. So for South Africa, the hope was that if you could permit the legal importation of cheap generic drugs, that there was no global fund, there was no big donor thing. The feeling was you're going to have to kind of do it on your own. But also there was an economies of scale thing. So the generic drug companies in India were not going to scale up to provide cheap AIDS drugs for a very small number of patients. And so you needed, in a way, a big enough market for the generic drugs. And so people were focusing on, before the donors showed up, they were focusing on, well, you know, what combination of private employers, such as Anglo-American, for example, a big mining company, was, I think, played a very constructive and important role during this period. Brian Brink and particularly Dr. Brink, because they were looking at the cost of retraining mine workers. I mean, I think Brian Brink, he wanted to do it for just the regular old humanitarian reason, but it was justified to his own board of directors and shareholders as cheaper to provide drugs than to retrain workers. They just said they were dying all the time. Mine workers were in a particular problem because they were away from their families, they were using prostitutes, and AIDS was kind of at the time in that particular area kind of related a lot to the sex workers. But Anglo-America began to kind of push the idea that private employers could pay for things. People are trying to get the South African government or other governments that had more money. And the other thing where people were looking at was, we were saying, well, before there was donors, we said, if the price is low enough, you can imagine people that have jobs as teachers or engineers or things like that. And we said for a lot of these countries, they educate people, they become teachers or engineers, and they're the elites in that country. But if they die, that's a big loss to the country as well. I mean, they're an important part of the economy of that country. It was really devastating to the country because it was so difficult in so many different ways, as I'm sure you can imagine. So you were losing a whole large number of middle-class people as well that were helping to kind of give hope for the future in terms of where the economy was going. So people were kind of trying to piece together different ways you can imagine, cobble together a big enough market you can induce a company from India or something like that to go in and make some cheap knockoff drug. It's not costless for a generic drug company to school itself in how to make the drugs, to overcome some of the distribution issues and things like that. But eventually, what transformed everything was when the momentum really gathered for the Global Fund and in the United States for the PEPFAR program. Those two programs really primed the pump, and they provided the resources, which to this day have been the backbone of the funding for treatment for the majority of patients in Africa. By the way, that's really a tough program right now because the financial crisis, the CIPLA deal, the dollar a day price.
CIPLA is
one of the Indian generic manufacturers. I'll just give you some background on how this sort of came out with CIPLA. And as you know, Dr. Amit is featured a lot in the film. I'd been to India first time around 1996 on broader discussions with governments in a big regional meeting about what to do about the patents and medicines issue. And when I was there, I ran out of medicine for asthma. I'm asthmatic, and air quality wasn't great in the town I was in. And I needed some medicine, so I went to a pharmacy, and I found the drug I was using. It was manufactured by CIPLA, and I kind of looked around, and I noticed it was priced about $1 a month for the drug I was paying about, you know, on patent would cost around $35 in the United States. So, you know, it struck me at the time that, well, that was a pretty good outcome because a person who made $1 a day could work one day and pay for his kid to have medicine for asthma for the whole month. I thought that was, and you could see that India was being pushed to change its patent law under the WTO agreement. And that's what people were concerned about. Would you still have those low-cost drugs in India after the WTO rules went into effect? But I kind of remember the name of the company that manufactured it because I brought some home and continued. The name of the company was CIPLA. So after triple therapy came in the market and people began to realize the benefits of it.
It's triple therapy for AIDS treatment.
For HIV treatment. If you thought about the AIDS treatment, it was obvious that up until 1996, everybody was dying north and south, as Dylan said. And then after 1996, there was a two-tier world. There was the people that had access to the drugs and the people that didn't have access to triple therapy at the time. And so when I started to have conversations with people that might know more about who could actually manufacture a drug, I asked this gentleman, Bill Haddad, who is one of the founders of the U.S. modern generics industry. I asked him if he could put me in touch with CIPLA. It was one company I was aware of, and you know, I didn't know the name of too many companies there. Some of the other famous companies were like Rambaxi and other firms. And he tracked down Dr. Hamid through a friend of his that dealt with raw materials, a lot of which were purchased in India and sent to the United States. That's how I first made contact with this guy. But the challenge was to kind of get over the hump of the generic drug companies at the time. The problem was if they were going to sell a drug outside of India. Now, by the way, India had almost no access to treatment at this time. So CIPLA was not making drugs for the Indian population, which was a fairly significant size of HIV population. They were primarily manufacturing HIV drugs for Brazil. Brazil had made the market for generic AIDS drugs at that point, and with a fairly small outlays, they were spending about $100 to $150 million a year in Brazil to provide triple therapy for people starting around 1996, 1997. And Brazil pioneered this. When Brazil first started doing it, the generic prices were not much different than the branded prices. They'd be a little bit lower. They'd be like 20% lower or something, but they were still really high. To give you an example, and I hope not to bore you with too much economics, but one drug, just to give you an illustration, called 3TC, was one of the three drugs you'd use in generic drug manufacturing for treatment for AIDS. Well, 3TC, the raw material cost for the active pharmaceutical ingredient in the drugs, the generic price out of India to Brazil initially was $25,000 a kilo to buy the active ingredients. After a couple years of buying generic drugs, the price had fallen to under $5,000 a kilo, and then it was headed south. And as we looked at raw material prices, you could look at it over time, and you'd find that the prices were rapidly falling. But it depended on someone being out there to purchase enough that you begin to see entry and competition. So first you'd have one company, then you'd have a second company, a third company. And by the time you get three companies, you really begin to have a lot of competition. And so Brazil was making the market. So even though Brazil was in South America, it really made treatment opportunities in Africa possible because they were buying generic drugs because they didn't have patents yet of the older AIDS drugs in Brazil. And they were buying enough of the generic drugs that you begin to see some competition. But when I talked to CIPLA, they wanted to charge a much higher price. They wanted to kind of ride the branded price down and let it sort of slowly down. And I talked to Dr. Amit and I said, look, we need something more dramatic. We need to shake people up because people are telling us that even if we overcome the patent thing, we won't get a big enough break in the price to make a difference and it'll still be too costly to do in Africa. I said, I want you to give me the dollar a day price which I knew that they could do. And he was quite reluctant at first because he said, well, you know, the problem we have is if we ship drugs, people don't pay for them, or we have to pay for all the registration costs, or we may have to sort of, I don't know, bribing doctors isn't the right word, but in some countries you had to give a lot of financial incentives for doctors to prescribe your products. And a lot of the things in the distribution were really inefficient and they were really difficult. And I said to him, look, give me the price if we bring a truck up to your factory and you just load up the truck with factory, and then we take care of the registration, we take care of the distribution, we pay hard cash for it, we buy in bulk, what price can we get? And that's where we arrived at that particular price. And initially they just made the price available to Doctors Without Borders as kind of a humanitarian price. It wasn't really described as something that anybody could buy, but within a matter of weeks after they announced the price, it became the price that everyone could buy. And actually by the end of the year, price had fallen to $240 or something like that. So I mean, it was on its way down, so the prices fell fairly fast after that. But I think that the critical thing for him was to get kind of an eye-popping, catch your imagination price down there. So it forced people to deal with the fact that if you overcame the patent barriers, it would make a difference. People would go from not having access to having access.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the film Fire in the Blood. And we're talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, one of the major figures in the film and the whole movement to get African people access to AIDS medications. All of this, the fight that you've been talking about to actually get the drugs, to get around the patents, to bust through the patents, to get the price down to a level where it could be distributed to millions of people all throughout the continent, and there would be access to it, and people, presumably it had a huge impact. I wanted to ask you, I want you to let people know, what was the actual impact of this tremendous change? What was the impact of that? What changed? And in the film, it's dramatized pretty heavily by, you see some of the people who were dying, with they seemed to be just breathing ghosts at the time, but then a little while later, they're perfectly healthy, comparatively. What was the actual result of all that you fought to get?
Before we started this campaign, if you lived in a developing country and you got AIDS, you were going to die within X number of years, you'd be dead of AIDS. After the campaign, if you had AIDS, most people in the developing world could get access to treatment. And that's where things stand right now. I don't know the exact number today. It's certainly over 4 million. I don't know if they're over 5 or 6. The numbers are much bigger right now. But you've gone from, I think there was between 10 and 20,000 primarily white people in Africa that had treatment back in 2001 to, I don't know, 4 or 5 million people that have access in sub-Saharan Africa and throughout other developing countries. So it was just a big revolution in access. And those people, they may die of something else, but they're much less likely to die of AIDS right now. So it was a huge difference.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in the film, and you mentioned it, you referred to it here a little bit earlier, was there was an immediate slapback that came pretty quickly. There was a slapback that came from pharma, that came from the various governments, and in particular the WTO, and all these things that developed. Explain to people what happened. Once people had access, all of this had taken this big leap, and then it was a slapback. What was it?
I mean, nothing was easy. I mean, there was every step of the way, every time we'd achieve some success in some forum, whether it was getting the World Trade Organization to change the way that its rules on patents worked in 2001, or getting the first countries to formally override the patent right in order to allow cheap AIDS drugs to be made and things. There was always a strategy by big companies to frustrate everything and to maintain as much as control as possible. One of the things that they did is they tried to initially make it as difficult as possible to register through the regulatory process generic drugs, claiming they were unsafe. One of the things they did is they got the Bush administration officials in charge of it to require that they wouldn't pay for any AIDS drugs unless they were registered with the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. And so even though there was like a regulatory entity, for example, in South Africa that was considered a fairly decent regulatory body, it still have to get the drugs registered in the United States. And that created a lag time between when the generics were available and when people really started to use them. Eventually, though, I think that worked out in a positive way because there was over 50 registrations of generic products with the U.S. FDA. And that was sort of the gold standard for quality. So now people know that you can buy FDA-approved drugs in Africa. One drug, for example, one combination, cost around $25,000 in the United States. You can buy for about $200 outside the United States, and they're both FDA approved. So you have now some of the confidence people have in the generics was actually, I think, probably in the long run, it was helped out by that. But they tried all sorts of things. They tried to, and also these problems haven't really stopped. It wasn't as if they were totally overcome. You have a situation right now where the drug companies are trying to, they recently changed the leadership of the Global Fund in Geneva, this big organization which provides donor support for AIDS treatment around the world. And the previous executive director was pushed out from France. It's been replaced by someone formerly from the Bush administration. And the United States, under the Obama administration is trying to actually push much tougher rules in trade agreements than the Bush administration did. The Bush administration, they were not great on these issues, but on critical moments, they gave up just enough to make things happen. Like in 2001, they agreed to changes in the WTO rules about pharmaceutical drugs. In 2007, they agreed to a big change in the World Intellectual Property Organization to put humanitarian and development interests more to the fore. They modified some of our trade agreements with some developing countries to allow them. They actually walked back and gave back some of the rules they had on things that specifically involve pharmaceutical monopolies and things, and made it easier to put generic drugs in the market. And when the Obama administration came in, they've actually tried to roll back those concessions we got from the Bush administration. Nels Delorean, the Undersecretary of Department of Health for the Obama administration, is leading the attack on this treaty. Incidentally, his work used to be funded by Merck before, and he was involved in efforts back in 2001 to try and undermine the compulsory licensing campaigns on AIDS drugs. He was working to kind of defeat these access measures we were working, and he was funded by the drug companies, and now he's an undersecretary for the Obama administration. And the person he hired to work on these issues, Holly Wong, used to work for pharma as a lobbyist. And so it's not as if things are great today necessarily. They're tough.
What will the impact be just concretely on people? Millions of people have survived AIDS at this point. What is the situation looking from here to the future?
For AIDS, I think we won the battle about the drugs you could buy 10 years ago. Those drugs, which are effective and useful for a lot of patients, are now available for less than $100 per year throughout the developing world. That's been a big success, but some patients are going to develop resistance to those drugs. They're no longer considered the best drugs or even the proper standard of care for treatment for AIDS patients. So the newer drugs, the newer generation of drugs, that's where the current fight is at. And there's a big battle over that. And the WTO changes means that since 2005, there's been all countries are now required to grant patents on these drugs, so it's been more difficult. And so there's more patents in more countries on the newer AIDS drugs. So there's a fight over access to the new AIDS drugs. And that's a big struggle. There's something called the medicines patent pool. They're trying to acquire licenses to manufacture the generic drugs in developing countries right now. So that's one battle. If you go outside of AIDS, it's huge. It's a huge problem. The Obama administration has fought the idea that you would grant compulsory licenses on cancer drugs or drugs for diabetes or asthma or other kinds of diseases. They've tried to, they concede that there's been some concessions made in the AIDS area, and in fact, they have to actually, the United States is the biggest purchaser of generic drugs throughout the world because we're the biggest donor for people on treatment, particularly in Africa. So they recognize that there's some reason to bend a little bit as far as AIDS drugs are concerned, although they haven't been great, but they haven't been horrible either. But when it gets to cancer drugs and things like that, they are really, really, it's like old school. We're going back to the old days. Their attitude is a little bit like, well, if you live in India right now has a case involving a cancer drug by a German company, Bayer, that costs $70,000 a year for liver or kidney cancer. One of the disputes in this case is whether or not $70,000 a year is a reasonably affordable price in India. Well, I don't think anyone thinks $70,000 is an affordable price in India. I mean, the per capita income last year was $1,500 per year. So, $70,000 is not an affordable price really in the United States. I mean, it's not really an affordable price anywhere, but it's certainly not an affordable price in India. So the Obama administration has intervened with the Prime Minister of India, with the Minister of Commerce. They have people there this week basically working that crazy. They created an interagency team to more or less push back in India against the granting of this compulsory license.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the film Fire in the Blood. And we're talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, one of the major figures in the film and the whole movement to get African people access to AIDS medications. At the end of the film, there's a statistic that says 18 million people a year are dying from preventable diseases, curable diseases. What does it make you feel to live in a world where really profit, all of that will actually mean on the ground that millions of people will die needlessly? How do you feel about living in that kind of world?
You know, you expect Pfizer or Merck or, you know, GlaxoSmithKline, you know, to do something. I mean, they're businesses. You kind of, it doesn't really shock you when they do something. What does shock me is when the Obama administration leans against poor people in developing countries, when the Obama administration is the problem, when the Obama administration is opposed to poor people having access to drugs that are cheap to manufacture, and they will die without access to those drugs.
Where to from here in terms of what you do?
The big hope that we have is that we can get out of these defensive battles we have where we're fighting this patent and that patent in this country and that country, and to radically change the way that you think about the way drugs development is financed. The key name for this new campaign is delinkage, and the idea is that you delink the price of the drug from the cost of the R&D. So some combination of incentives which are not linked to drug monopolies, like innovation prize funds that Professor Joe Stiglitz and others and our group of, and many others have supported, can be replaced as the incentive, or you have a more global cooperation on government funding too, things like what the NIH does. So the idea is you want to completely, radically change the way you think about drug development so that all drugs are generic all the time. Drugs are all priced like aspirin. That whether you have insurance or don't have insurance, whether you live in a developing country or you live in Switzerland, whether you're insured or uninsured, makes no difference whatsoever on access. And you just have different mechanisms to pay for the cost of developing, paying for the research and development. And it's feasible, it's cheaper, and it's really a failure of imagination for people. We almost have Stockholm syndrome over the current system we're in. We'd like to see the drug development model switched to this new model of an abundance of access, and that's possible. And so that's our campaign right now. And we have to do these things on compulsory licensing and fighting patent by patent and things like that. But what we really want to do is change the entire system.
All right, Jamie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we've just been talking about the film Fire in the Blood, about the withholding of AIDS medication from people who need it in Africa and other parts of the oppressed world. And we've been talking with the director of the film, Dylan Mohan Gray, and Dr. Jamie Love, one of the main participants in the film, and one of the people who was fighting the fiercest to get affordable AIDS medication for people in Africa and other parts of the oppressed world. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And as we go out, I want to leave you with this thought, something to really chew on here, all right? As Bob Avakian said in his recent film, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. Remind me once again, which system is it that's been a horror for all of humanity? Capitalism or socialism? Think about that, and I'll take your answers next week. All right, that brings us to the end of the show, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And you know what? Write to me if you are, no matter where you are in the country, if you want to contribute to this show, if you want to actually contribute your skills or you want to contribute your effort to this show, we can really use all the help we can get, all right? There's all kinds of things you can do. You'd be surprised. So just drop me a line at michaelslate@redfuture.com. You want to follow me, you can, on Twitter and Facebook. We're going to go out now with War Again from the Balkan Beatbox.
Join the gang with the bang bang and the same song we sang, coming over and over.